If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Headstuff Plus.
This show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Hello, I'm Joe Rooney.
I'm Patrick McDonald.
And we are Talking TED.
In this episode, we will be watching Grant Unto Him Eternal Rest.
And we'll be chatting to Ardla Hanlon. And there's a talk with Frank Kelly that I recorded on my podcast, Potteroony, a few years ago. And yeah, that was really good to talk to him. You know, when I was growing up, and I'm sure for you as well, he was on TV a lot. He was like, of the one person that was on Father Ted, for me, I was amazed that I was working with Frank Kelly.
I have a picture of me with my hair tied up like his character in Hull's Pictorial Weekly. And I was only about 3 or 4. Yes. I was obsessed with Frank Kelly at that age.
Yeah, for anyone that's not from Ireland, that was kind of a satirical political show that was on RTE during the 70s.
It was in the 70s, yeah. Yeah, it was absolutely brilliant. And Frank was a legend. And I got to work with him only about a year before he died. In Mull, at the Gaiety.
A John B. Keane play.
John B. Keane play, Mull. Featuring, I played a priest, and he was a bishop.
Wow. Mm. Let's have a look at the episode now. So there we did the opening there with Father Jack shouting, feck arse girls, which is, I loved it. I loved him shouting that. I'm sure he felt...
He was frustrated. Because he didn't get to say much. And I know in the episode I was in, he did have a little speech and he loved that. He revelled in that.
Yeah.
That he could, you know, they lie in wait like wolves. And he loved that. That was a big deal for him. So it was frustrating for... Was he classically trained? Well, he came from the theatre.
Well, he did the Abbey. He's an Abbey actor.
Abbey actor. Yeah, absolutely. Must have killed him every week to see people like Jim Norton coming in and having lots of lines, and he just said, but it was brilliant.
Well, he's brilliant at it. Yeah, he's always, transformation was unbelievable because you're talking to him, he's very erudite and...
Yeah, I did a play with him and he'd like be doing the crosshair on the Irish Times, you know, the really tough crossword. And he'd be doing that, like, you know, and talking about whatever. You know, but then when he came at the talk, when he did the character, he was brilliant. Just hilarious, you know.
Incredible.
Very funny.
I know that he's very frustrated also that he worked as an actor in the Abbey and also a comedian at the same time to earn money because he had a big family and all that. And that other actors, he felt looked down on him for doing that.
That's right.
For doing comedy.
Yeah, yeah. He was a straight man to one of those people like Jack Cruise and one of those. He had loads of stories about that time, you know. Backstage, like, you know, he'd be telling me in the Gaiety all about like some time there was a circus in the Gaiety and the monkey started shitting on the stage and all of that, you know.
Really?
Very funny, but I'd be just trying to remember my lines. I'm just about to go out to do a bit, but he'd be telling me this story about the monkey shitting everywhere and I'd be, oh, fuck, yeah. What am I going to say now? Where are we now? But
yeah.
Yeah. So it starts off with Dougal speaking to a nun awkwardly. Mm. Nuns aren't women in the Father Ted universe. They're different. They're a step down from women.
Right, yeah. But Dougal's awkward at everybody.
Yes. But, you know, I mean, I went to college in Maynooth and there were a couple of nuns there. Very attractive nuns.
Were they?
I have to say, yeah. I mean, at the time, like, a lot of women really fancied priests. They really, there was a cachet to go out with a priest. But some of the nuns, they were forbidden fruit, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they weren't not
to me,
sexual.
All women were forbidden fruit.
Oh, God. Yeah. Well, to me, completely. Poisonous. But they weren't poisonous. But, like, no, but nuns were kind of, yeah.
So anyway.
Ted and Dougal are in the room and they see Jack. They think he's dead. That's a spoiler. Because if you watch at the end, he's not dead, really. But we both went to Frank's funeral a few years back.
Frank Kelly, the actor.
Frank Kelly, yeah. I'd worked with him just the year before on Mull.
On Mull,
And he hadn't been well at that time. I think he might have had Parkinson's. I think it was only after Mull maybe said he had Parkinson's. Mm. We knew he had trouble remembering his lines, even though he's brilliant every night. Mm-hmm. He struggled with the lines and he wasn't quite his usual self. And
Yeah, and I interviewed him as we will hear it during this episode. quite near to when he died as well. And I called out to his house, actually, in Monkstown. And his wife was there. And she was...
Barbara.
Barbara. She's really nice and good chat. But I could see he was frail. Yeah. And then I know I was telling him I was going off to do a gig somewhere abroad. And his eyes lit up and you could see... God, he just wanted to get back out there performing.
Oh my God, like he was so, he put it to shame. Like, I mean, like he'd been through, he'd had cancer, he'd had all sorts of problems, didn't he? I mean, he had...
You know what happened to him? He was off, he was a man for swimming in the sea, in the cold water, and I think he was in the west of Ireland. He was getting back into the car or out of the car and he had the door open and the wind caught it and whacked his leg, like he had an awful injury on his leg.
But he was so, I mean, when I worked with him, he was so robust and he just wanted to get out and walk.
Yeah.
And he had hiking boots on all the time and that, and he was just so active and proactive as a person. He put you to shame. Like, we're, you know, I feel sorry for him. I have a comfort threshold, a high one or a low one, I can't remember.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't tend to put myself out there and...
Oh, I see.
Walk in the rain or whatever like that. Yeah, but he was so, like, I mean, he'd want to go anywhere in the world and walk and do whatever. Yeah. No fear.
Well, down in Clare, he was off walking any time, any day he had off.
Any day he'd off, he'd be out in the burn. We'd be avoiding it.
And walking 6-hour walks. Like,
yes, exactly.
Walks.
Yeah. Like, we were driven to the, you know, driven 30 yards up the road to the set or whatever. Yeah. But he'd be at walk. He was robust.
Very.
Built very different. People in those days were, you know, brought up in hard times and, you know.
Yeah, I guess they were, yeah.
More robust.
They seemed to have bigger hands as well.
My father had much bigger hands than me.
Me
like
too.
Like shovels. My father-in-law.
My father was smaller than me, but more robust.
Smaller than you?
Smaller than me,
wow.
Yeah.
My father was taller than me, but he had massive shovel hands. Just big, strong man. And none of us, and myself and my brothers, are weeds compared to him. But yeah, Frank was like that. And I worked with Des Keogh on the same film. And Des Keogh is in the start of the second series. I should probably wait. Or the start of the third series. And he's unbelievable. He's about 85 and he's still working.
Yeah.
And big hands and just...
big hands as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, you interviewed Frank for your podcast, Potterooney.
Potterooney, yeah. I did.
You spoke to him about Father Ted.
And I mean, he didn't know who... these young lads like Arthur who wrote this thing, he wasn't aware of them, and I'm sure at first he was a little wary of this.
Yeah, he didn't know. It was totally different. He had no frame of reference for this sort of humour, I'd say.
Yeah.
You know, because these guys were coming out of like a whole, there was a whole movement at the time, but slightly surreal offbeat comedy, like, you know, Reeves and Mortimer, the Fast Show, which they had worked on.
Yes, and he would not have been aware of that.
He would not have been aware of any of that movement in comedy, certainly, yeah.
He wouldn't have a clue who Ardle was. He would have known who Dermot Morgan was.
Yeah, he would have.
But Dermot Morgan would have been a young upstart to him.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I think I spoke about this earlier, but like Frank Kelly was a hero of mine when I was a kid because I loved, when I was only about 3 or 4, I would have watched Hall's Pictorial Weekly. We were allowed to stay up late. That was the only night we were allowed to stay up past 8:30 or whatever and watch it. And I knew every minister in the cabinet at the time because Hall's Pictorial Weekly was the only satirical show we had in Ireland. And my mother allowed us to watch it because it was during the coalition government, Fine Gael Labour, and they destroyed all of that generation.
Yeah, they used to have the Minister for Telegraph Poles and Lampposts.
Yeah, exactly. And Dimples O'Deary, Michael Early, and Garlick Fitzgargoyle. I think he played him, Garlick Fitzgerald. The Minister for Hardship. And So they really went to town on that coalition government.
Yeah.
I loved them. So he was an absolute hero.
And me too, yeah. Quite unbelievable. If I was, as a young child, if I thought I was actually going to act with that fella.
Yeah, it wouldn't have believed it.
Unbelievable.
No, I never thought I'd leave Drumiskin, like where I grew up. I thought I'd, you know, I don't know what, I thought it might have been a postman or something, maybe.
There's probably young fellas now who dream of acting with you, Patrick.
That's right, yeah. But that's not going to happen because I don't get many gigs acting. Yeah, maybe they do. Yeah, I know people have worked at me. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I worked.
I know. I appeared really, in, that's probably true.
I mean, I did a little scene with the Young Offenders, and I said, "Do you mind, lads, if I get my picture?" And they were saying, "Like, it's mad that I'm saying that to them because they grew up like thinking,
you
'Oh, your man off Father Ted and whatever else.'" Yeah. There's a Dougal pretending he's Father Jack. Very good from Ardle.
Yeah, that's a
do something non
Dougal.
Yeah. So the other thing is they wake Jack in this episode. I don't think English people
have wakes
like we have wakes. Mm. Like our family wakes were raucous.
Yeah.
And, you know,
a lot of drinking.
A lot of drinking and singing and joking and laughing. And people would be confused if they came in. Like people have come to wakes and they're like, really, oh, someone's dead. And they're really dead. And they can't believe everyone in the room is laughing.
Yeah.
And having the crack.
Remember the person who's dead.
I just remember being really hungover at my parents' funerals. Was really bad.
Both of them?
Both of them, yeah.
Wow. I wasn't hungover at my mother's funeral.
You were 11.
I was 11, yeah. But at my father's, I was,
Yeah, they don't celebrate. There not many people go to funerals in Britain, I think. Anywhere in the world. And it's
a weird
big thing. Always a big funeral. That was a big funeral.
Hey, oh, not a seat to be had.
No, exactly. Yeah. As we did a sketch.
Yeah.
But a lot of strangers. Yeah. You know, yeah. Even when my parents died, my brother's a teacher in Monaghan. Mm. And like all the parents from the school in Monaghan would come to the church in Louth.
Would they?
And it'd be just jammed. And like loads of people, all friends, any family would come. And you just have to stock up on drink.
And local politicians. Make sure they were there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. When I was trying to get planning permission out of me, that this Fianna Fáil fella came to look at the site, and I told him who my father was, and he was, oh yeah, I was at the funeral. I don't think he was at the funeral, but he was pretending he was.
Yeah, they'd have lookalikes.
Yeah. Polly McGlynn was brilliant though, I have to say, as Mrs. Doyle. What a great, like the parish priest housekeeper is a character, isn't it, in every parish. Or the woman who looks after the church as well. I know in Kentstown and Meath there was a woman who would put the flowers out in the altar and all that.
Yeah, sometimes there were the same job, but what was they called? Sacristan? Well, I can't remember. What sacristy or something? I can't remember what their name of that job was.
Sacristy is just sexton. Just the area behind.
Can't remember the altar. What their job was. Yeah,
but it's so recognisable, that woman. I think I remember a woman like that in Parish Weir.
Yeah, they would have. Yeah. And there were priest groupies as well. Like there were, they loved the priests, and there were loads of women. I used to go to mass every day when I was about 11 or 12. I'd get up every morning and go to mass. I loved it, like mad for it. And I went to church twice on Sundays, you know, to benediction as well as mass.
Yeah,
and there were certain women would go to everyone in stockings and a scarf and cardigans and old fashioned coats and that. And they were all dead now. I don't know who goes now.
What are those type of women doing now?
They're dead.
No, but what's the modern
equivalent?
Mrs. Doyle.
I don't know.
They're on Twitter, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, I liked the special masses. Like, I liked Ash Wednesday. I like going around with ashes on my forehead.
I love that.
Ash Wednesday, yeah.
Or, sticking your finger in the ashtray and just doing it, just to pretend.
And Palm Sunday.
Palm Sunday, and then Easter was great. I was an altar boy, so you'd be on every night at Easter. It was brilliant.
There was one mass where your throat was blessed. Did you ever?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I would still, I stopped taking the host when the hand was introduced. So I still, if I have to go, I wouldn't know how to do it, which hand to put up. Would you? Just to get me tongue.
No, I'd rather the tongue.
Yeah. That was much easier. I used to hold the plate underneath.
Oh, yeah.
I'd go around that. And then I never caught one, ever.
Never fell.
Very disappointed that I never, ever caught. You just love to have caught it.
Yeah, it would be good. And were you told then you weren't allowed to let it touch your teeth?
Yeah.
I don't know why that
was. There was a story went around the Christian Brothers when I wasn't there, that there was once a boy who was just given communion and he puked up all over the chapel. And the Christian brother ate the puke. Yeah. Because the host was so holy that you couldn't let it go to waste. You couldn't just sweep it up or let the dog.
Yeah.
Or whatever. You wouldn't let the dog vomit. But, that it was that precious that you couldn't get sick. That's probably why you couldn't eat before, an hour before.
Yeah, in case you got sick.
Communion, yeah.
We were told a story about a girl who wanted to have communion, and she was too young. But she loved Jesus so much, she really wanted to what would you call it, have her Holy Communion or whatever. Oh, yeah. And she was too young, but she loved Jesus. But she was at Mass one day and she loved Jesus so much, the host just came off the priest's hand and floated down towards her and into her mouth. We were told that.
Wow.
It's true.
Yeah. But she hadn't made her Holy Communion or anything.
No, she hadn't. But Jesus was, Jesus as the host.
Yeah. Yeah. My wife was in a hospital when she was a child and I don't know, 5 or 6, and the priest came around and said, have you made Holy Communion? And she took it and she just felt so guilty about this that she'd taken when I haven't made her communion.
Right, yeah.
And just really worried about that. Imagine in those days.
Oh, there's the young Father Jack.
Yes.
That's amazing. That's what he really looks like.
Because in the first episode, he's leering at young girls, but there he's screaming hell and whatever at the kids,
Yeah.
We did a sketch in The Savage Eye where you've got John Colleary playing the priest, shouting like that, hell and all this. And then I'm the younger 70s priest talking about contraception.
Right.
You know, when the fellow man puts his thing in the where the lady goes. When the man puts his, where he goes to the toilet into where the lady puts it to the toilet and that. And and we forgot. And then you look at that, forever looking at sketches or scenes in Ted and thinking, oh, geez, that's very like the sketch we did years later.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Must have subconsciously influenced us.
Yeah, that's interesting. That scene with Jack in the earlier episode, I don't think that would have got through the censors now.
Not at all, no.
We're now going to chat to Ardla Hanlon, who played Father Dougal Maguire. Hi, Ardla. Listen, thanks a lot for joining us here on the podcast.
Oh, listen, no bother. It's just great to be back.
Yeah. And we're watching the 6th episode on season 1. And just, you know, Frank Kelly is a legend of Irish comedy. And before Father Ted, obviously, you would have watched him on Hall's Pictorial Weekly, yeah?
Yeah, I would. It was one of the few programmes we were allowed to watch growing up. I mean, we had a television in our house, but we weren't allowed to watch very often. Strictly rationed to about an hour a day. And because obviously you could get eye cancer or whatever. So or radiation poisoning was the other big fear. But anyway, yeah, one of the few things we were allowed to watch was Hall's Pictorial Weekly because it was kind of newsy and politics and kind of educational. And Frank was there, and Eamon Morrissey as well, who turned up in Father Ted.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And Eamon and Frank had a great double act, a few double acts in that show. And it was really great for its time. Like, I don't know if it stands up now, but at the time, like, we loved it. You know, it was probably one of the only examples of TV comedy in Ireland back then in the 70s, wasn't it?
It was genuinely good and funny.
Oh, yeah. God, yeah.
And
it
very
terrible. Yeah, even I was only about 4 watching that. And it made me interested in politics as well. I got into the whole Garlic Fitzgerald and the Minister for Hardship.
Richie Ruin.
Interestingly, you come from a Fianna Fáil family. I think.
Did you have to bring that up?
Sorry about that. But you know that it was criticised at the time for going really hard on the coalition, Fine Gael Labour coalition of that time. Was it very popular with your father?
That's probably why we were allowed to watch it then. But I remember, like, because he was a very busy man, and he would very rarely sit down and watch TV unless it was the news. But he always made an exception for that as well, and he got a bit of a kick out of it. But yeah, and then Frank was on the radio as well, doing similar stuff later on, Only Slagging and things like that. So I was always very aware of him as a comedy figure in Ireland, and just a great trooper. You know, you'd see him the odd time you'd ever be brought to the theatre or something like that, he'd be in it normally.
Yeah.
So, you know, he was very familiar with him. So, of course, when you end up working with him, you think this is, you know, you're kind of pinching yourself. This is great, you know, to be part of that continuum in Irish entertainment.
And is that the first time you would have met him in person, working on Father Ted?
I think so, yeah. I'm trying to remember. I'm pretty sure it was, yeah. It probably was. Now, like, Ireland being Ireland, naturally enough, Frank Kelly was at school with my father.
Wow.
Maybe a year behind or something, or 2 years behind, but they knew each other, like, growing up vaguely.
Oh.
Right. His father had worked for Dublin Opinion, was it, or one of those magazines?
Yeah, I think so,
Did he draw cartoons? Was that his thing?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
Must have paid well then.
I'm sure Frank told me, but I didn't take in everything Frank told me. Frank was a great raconteur, you know, so like, and because Frank, you know, during Father Ted, like, he didn't have an awful lot to do. Now, what he did really well, and it was great to watch him in action, but he'd a lot of downtime, you know, particularly during the rehearsal. So he was always, and he just loved talking. Like, Frank could talk forever. So, and if he got you like at a weak moment, you know, like you'd be trapped. Now, you know, I'm not saying a lot of what he had to say was very interesting, but, you know, a lot of it would just go over your head, like, because he just one story after another, one anecdote after another, one song after another. He'd sing to you during the day.
Those Abbey actors are into that, right? Yeah. Telling stories of being on sets or being in plays.
I was in a play with him before, about a year before he died. I was in Mull in the Gaiety. And normally I'd have anecdotes and stories about everything I'm in. But he told so many anecdotes. He cornered me the whole time we did it. And lovely man. But he did tell me all these anecdotes and stories and everything. And Des Keogh kind of stayed away and, you know, he was on it. And he would have lots of interesting stories, but he tended to be concentrated on the play and rehearsing and whatever. But Frank told so many anecdotes. I have no anecdotes from Mull because that's all I ever heard.
Yeah, but when you're that age, you'll be telling loads of your anecdotes.
Yeah, but your anecdotes are anecdotes about Frank Kelly telling you anecdotes.
That's it. That's the problem.
Yeah.
But he would be, you'd be about to go on stage. Literally, I'm trying to remember your lines, I'm trying to be focused. And he'd be telling you about some like monkey who'd been doing a show and had shat on the stage and all that. I have to focus. I remember that monkey.
Yeah, no, but he's great. And he was very much part of that generation. And he's very typical of that generation. Like, you know, any little keyword or anything will just trigger a story.
Yeah.
He'd also take out the violin.
Did he?
Drop of a hat, yeah. Particularly, well, you know, when we'd be on location, he'd always have his violin very handy. Mm. Very close to hand, and any lull at all and the violin might come out. But no, I remember one time, like, we were filming it must have been the Doppelganger episode. Do you remember the Doppelganger priests were three priests from Rugged Island?
Oh yes.
So it was one of those episodes, and I wonder was it the sort of Where the lookalike competition. It could have been that one. Anyway, it was outdoors. There was a lot of outdoor filming that day and the weather was shocking, as it often was down in County Clare where we were filming. And so we're all sitting around in these caravans for the day pretty much, you know, waiting for the weather to clear. And there was about 10 elderly priests around. Could have been the All Priest Five-a-Side or something, maybe. Either. Anyway, there's loads of priests around. And of course, they're sharing anecdotes and you're sitting there going, and you're just like, bamboozled by it, just the sheer energy of these men, like, and the sheer store of stories that they have to draw on. Incredible stuff.
Yeah.
And I remember Frank, he hadn't gone in for a while, and they were name dropping like nobody's business, you know. They were talking about Olivier, working with Olivier on the London stage and everything. So they all had these great experiences. And then Frank hadn't gone in for a while, and they were talking about radio plays, and he said, "When I listen to a radio play, I simultaneously translate it into French and Italian."
Jesus Christ! Wow.
He was a very learned man. He was a qualified lawyer, which I think he did later in life. He went back to college and or he did an online course or whatever. But I mean, you know, he was an all-rounder.
And he liked to go for a fairly long walk, didn't he?
Bracing walk.
Yeah,
swam,
or swim.
I think he swam.
Cycled, did everything.
Did he
take part in Superstars in the 70s? I think he said he did. I'd have to look it up.
But I do remember he went for a walk and Pauline McGlynn said she'd go with him when we were down there in Clare. And she came back like 8 hours later, knackered. It was like an eight-hour hike.
He was extraordinary.
And he'd be talking the whole time. That would be, you know, you're walking and talking for 8 hours.
Extraordinary stamina, you know.
And do you know what he thought of Father Ted at the very beginning? What did he think of the writing?
I really don't know. I don't know. I mean, you know, he'd be offering advice, like. and he'd be offering Dermot a lot of advice. And I think he, you know, there would have been a little bit of rivalry between him and Dermot, given that they were sort of both in that sort of political satire area. Yeah. So they might, you know, I don't know how well they got on, really. Mm. But that was, you know, it was grand. There was never any tension or anything. And Frank used to say himself, because of his makeup, which was pretty hideous, he felt that it repulsed people. So that people wouldn't come near him on the days we were filming because he was all covered in these sores and scabs and stuff, you know. So he felt very lonely during it, I think. But I think as time went on, like we all did, you know, you begin to appreciate it more and more and more as the public appreciated more and more. And I think he felt very lucky, certainly by the end of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember like the first time you rehearsed with him? Did he have that character straight away? Or was he being directed to?
I think he probably came with it. Yeah, no, I think it was probably fairly intact. I mean, you know, they probably liked. I know the writers did like they loved Frank growing up as well. Like certainly Arthur did anyway, and you know, they probably had a fair idea what he was going to do. You know what I mean? Like he was cast for a reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, still, although the same, it's very different to him. It's polar opposite to him as a person. Opposite.
Yeah, because he's a very erudite man, and I think actors, like I find myself doing that as well, because people think I'm really stupid. So I sometimes in radio interviews start using big words and trying to be more intellectual, you know, so as people wouldn't confuse me with the character. And I think Frank, there was an element of that with Frank. So like, you know, he actually spoke quite a posh accent. You know, he was very erudite. He could quote literature and theatre and plays, and you know, so and he loved opera and things like that. So, you know, he was very cultured man.
It was a brilliant performance, though. I mean, it's not everyone could do that or nail it like that. I mean, it seems like a one-dimensional type of character.
But
he absolutely nailed it. The timing was perfect.
Yeah.
And he didn't hold back.
And the key thing, and I think particularly with sitcom, but, you know, with all drama and film and TV, is that he's likable. You know, no matter how repulsive a character he is, you still kind of feel for him. And there's times like where Ted and Dougal get very sentimental about him, you know, and I think that episode that we were talking about, like that's one of them where look at him there, you know.
Yeah. That's right.
So how did you feel coming towards the end of this first season of Father Ted? How big was it, or did you think it was just a cult show?
I can't remember now.
Were you getting recognised already?
I don't know.
At the end of
the first season.
The end of the
Father Ted.
It wasn't broadcast when he was filming. Are you talking about after it was broadcast? Yeah.
I am, yes.
Okay. I just wasn't clear.
Listen, you two, get your stories.
Okay. let's say when the first season went out, then, for Patrick's sake.
Yeah.
I can't really remember. I mean, it is a very long time ago, and a lot has happened in the meantime.
9/11.
Well, I just remember at the end of it all, like, we definitely would have felt very good about it. It was a good standard, I think, throughout the first series. So, you know, we felt that come what may, this is grand and we've done a good job.
Right.
So there was definitely that. I don't think it took off in a massive way here in Ireland anyway. I remember the reviews were very unkind at the time. Like, I think there was one exception in the Sunday Press. And he kind of got it and he liked it.
Was that Eddie Holt?
No, it was a guy called Aina Brophy.
Oh, okay.
I remember. And everyone else dismissed it and said, oh, you know, just like
Paddywhackery,
that kind of thing. And disgracing ourselves in front of the English, the English audience.
Yeah.
But I don't know. So it was really the second series where it like caught fire, I think, particularly in Ireland.
Yeah, well, and when did you get a BAFTA? Was that during the second?
I can't remember now, to be honest with you. There was, I'm sure after the first series, we were probably nominated for things in British Comedy Awards. I think I got an award for the first series, I think, but I'm not sure. Yeah, I think I did for British TV Comedy Award for Top TV Comedy Newcomer.
Yeah.
I think that was first series, but because it must have been because I was a newcomer.
Yeah. Right,
yeah. and I think the show was certainly nominated. It might have even won things at that award. And that used to be a fairly big do in those days, the British Comedy Awards. So that would have been 1995.
It certainly seemed like it was about the level of, say, the Fast Show or, you know, the Reeves and Mortimer type, that sort of niche on BBC Two or Channel 4. It hadn't taken off into the thing it became at that stage.
Yeah. But that was really exciting. Like, just you mentioned those shows, and like, they were the shows that I absolutely loved in those days. And to be suddenly, I suppose this was a big deal for me, was to be suddenly at these do's and events, rubbing shoulders with these people. Like, that was just great. You just felt like, you know, oh my God, we belong in this company. This is amazing, you know. And that was just, I suppose for me, that was probably the the best part of being in a show like that at that time.
Yeah, I'd say Frank and Dermot weren't aware of that movement in comedy, or probably.
Yeah, weren't. And you know, they were at very different stages of the career than I was, like, for example. Yeah. You know, so I was kind of, I had just gone to London as a stand-up comedian. I was getting on great. This is what I wanted, having arsed around in Dublin for 10 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was all going very well. And so I was, you know, very giddy and excited about everything. And I suppose they were at very different stages of the career. For Dermot, like, this was such a big deal. Like, you know, getting recognition in Britain was a big deal. He felt he'd been very neglected in Ireland by RTE and Irish TV. Mm. So, you know, for him, this was a really big deal. And I guess he was you know, he was just on a different mission or whatever than I was. Mm. And then for Frank, I don't know.
Like, I suppose it was a gig more than
that. It was a gig, exactly, yeah. Mm. Yeah, he'd seen it all at that stage.
And, yeah.
And were you doing stand-up all the way through, like, the filming of that first series?
Yeah, I was, yeah. I'd be, most nights at rehearsal, I'd be going straight to a gig. The weekends, I would have been gigging.
Little clubs.
Little clubs around London, mostly, yeah. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
You've done a bit of telly, though. I'd seen you on the Late Late Show before that went out, I think.
I'd done a tiny bit of telly.
A tiny,
like,
bit?
Yeah.
But, like, if you're obsessed with comedy, like, I suppose I was, and that, you know, I'd been aware of you before.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
And then
I'd done one TV series in Ireland called Hamlet and Her Brothers.
Oh,
yeah! It was a rare sort of a comedy drama, written and directed by Ferdie McKenna.
Wow!
And it was actually not bad. And you know, before its time, in the sense that Hamlet was played by a woman, and I played the Ophelia character, who was, I think, Owen was my name. And that's where, Arthur will always tell you this, that's where he first got the idea of me for Dougal.
Oh, right.
Because of whatever, you know, and I had no idea how to act or anything like that. But it's just, you're just doing what you think is the right thing to do. And Arthur saw that, and he liked the Owen character in that, even though I was only in three or four scenes.
Wow.
But he thought, oh, there's something, that naivety or whatever that I was bringing to that character, he felt would be useful for Dougal later on.
Yes.
You know, it was a good 2 or 3 years later, but he remembered it.
Thanks for chatting to us again, Ardle. What a man, Ardle.
He's a mensch.
Lovely fella.
We're going to take a break here and plug another podcast.
So have a listen now.
My name is Keane.
And I'm James. And we host Sissy That Pod.
Sissy That Pod is a fun, informative and comprehensive companion podcast into the world of the queer and colourful cultural behemoth that is RuPaul's Drag Race. Join us every week as we cover the current season of the show, All Stars 7, through the eyes of two queer Irish fans.
Or scour through our back catalogue wherever you get your podcasts, or on headstuffpodcast.com to check out the other seasons we've covered.
But for now, start your engine.
It's time to crown an ultimate queen.
This show is a part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network. To support the show, and for bonus content and lots more, you can become a member of Headstuff Plus. Go to headstuffpodcasts.com.
And this is an interview I did with Frank Kelly on my podcast, Potteroony, which is also on the Headstuff Podcast Network, if you want to have a listen to that. And I went out to his house out in around the Monkstown, I believe it was, and chatted to him there in his living room. And we play that for you now.
Things were very quiet for me for a few months before the tag came. I wasn't in work.
Yeah.
And I went to that interview, and the two guys, Graham and Arthur, were sitting there. And it wasn't very encouraging, because Arthur's in kind of drawl, and he's a lovely guy. He's become a friend. And Graham had this rather shy, diffident way with him. Handed me a piece of paper with every expletive that you could ever think of on it. And would I shout them, please, you know?
Yeah.
And I thought, my God, I've done things, but okay, in the privacy of this room, I can do this. So I did it.
Yeah.
And they looked at each other for a while, and they talked quietly in the corner, and then eventually they said, will you do it? And I said, what?
And then
they began to tell me then about Father Jack.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah. See, what people don't realise about Father Jack is that he has a real character. He's not just a series of shouts.
Yeah.
He's a real person with an accent. It's a kind of a leash accent.
Yeah.
And he just, you've got to inhabit the character if you're an actor. And I am an actor, and I'm proud of that.
Yeah.
And he's a success. But he doesn't consist in just sitting down shouting things.
Oh, no. I mean, I always thought the transformation from you to Father Jack was unbelievable. You wouldn't even believe it was you from looking at it.
You wouldn't really know. No. Not looking at this scrawny person. No. No. I had a, you know, the Michelin man, the ad, the big figure.
Yeah.
That's been 100 years in books. Yeah. They had a suit like that. I had to wear that underneath the clothes. Yeah. And it zipped up from the crotch to the neck. Mm. So you were in it, you were trapped in that, and then you get into the suit. Mm. And halfway through the day, of course, you get an urge to go for a pee.
Mm.
That might be on set. It's pretty agonising.
Mm.
I associate that suit with long periods of agony.
Jesus, really? Mm. What did you have to just wait?
Wait and wait, yeah.
And what about makeup? Did that take a while?
Because makeup took over 2 hours. It took about 2.25 hours initially.
Yeah.
And of course, the makeup artist got it down to about just an hour or something eventually.
After a while. Yeah.
And they had all sorts of strange miscellaneous objects, materials in the makeup, like porridge and cornflakes. And
they'd stick them
up into my hair. Yeah. And then I had a dummy eye. I had a false, an opaque contact lens in one eye, which was itchy and troublesome always.
Yeah.
And so between that and bursting for a pee and the heat of the uniform, of the outfit, it was stressful physically.
Yeah. And how did you feel then about the first series, once the first series was done?
I heard the audience reaction to what we had filmed down in County Clare, I was just amazed because they laughed themselves putrid.
Mm.
And I'm listening to audiences. I'm trying to gauge the reaction all my life, all my working life. Yeah. I've never heard anything like that.
Mm.
My God, tonight I have never heard laughter like it, which is infectious because it drives you on.
Yeah.
Everybody, you know well from performing on the stage as a stand-up comic.
Yeah.
That it drives you to better work. You perform better on the back of the laughter, you know.
Yeah, it's a back and forth thing between performer and audience, isn't it?
It is. It's a chemistry.
Yeah. And yeah, that must, and it's a big studio where they record it. It's a big audience, so it's quite a...
It was very reassuring that you hadn't wasted your time down in Clare, you know. Although we had a nice time in Clare.
Yeah.
You know?
And the times then, I know you thought this is going to be great. Did you think it's going to be great with the watching audience, the at-home audience watching on TV? Did you have any idea it was going to be so big?
That was enough confirmation for me of what happened in the studio.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Oh, no. Nobody could say it was going to be so big.
Mm-hmm.
Or that Dermot Morgan, when he died very sadly at the very end of the last episode, that he was almost of a state funeral.
Mm.
Every politician was there, and it was just extraordinary. You'd never realise that anything could generate so much interest and notice, including that's not to play down Dermot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the tragedy of his death was enormous too.
Mm.
But of course, there were never going to be any more.
Father Ted's, even no matter what.
The two guys had decided, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think they were right because people could nearly write their own at that stage. Mm-hmm. And when they have these conventions down in Aran Islands and things like that, everybody run around dressed as Father Jack.
Mm.
You can see that they would have written their own.
Did you know Dermot before Father Ted? Were you?
I did, yes. Yeah. He was a very ambitious person.
Mm.
Very preoccupied all the time with the next gig, the next movement, the next movement in his career.
Mm.
And you always felt he was looking over your shoulder at something, at a better opportunity.
Mm.
And that was a kind of neurosis. It wasn't that he was a nasty person. I think it resulted from the fact that he was a rather late entrant into the business. He'd been teaching St. Michael's School and things like that. But Dermot, he hadn't a breadth of experience that other people would have. He hadn't worked in legitimate theatre at all.
Mm.
And he was always just about getting his act together with loads of talent and great bursts of talent and, you know, bursts of public interest in what he did. But he was very tense and very ambitious.
Mm.
And the sad thing is that when he died, it was all about to happen. There were about 3 or 4 things lined up that he could have done that would have given him international fame, you know. But he was a late entrant to the business by my standard.
Mm.
Because I was doing it from the age of 17. And indeed, I remember doing cabarets. My father sending me out to entertain various societies and things, groups, play the fiddle and sing, that kind of thing. Mm. But Dermot hadn't that experience.
I remember, because when I was down shooting in Clare, you'd shoot all day and then you'd relax, but he was apparently gone writing after he shot all day. He was writing another script or something. So
he wasn't writing another script. He'd been making notes.
Making notes or something. Yeah, so, okay. He was just pushing himself a bit. I don't know. Didn't seem to be relaxing anyway.
And if he was very rude to you, if he was talking to you and he didn't give you his attention and he was insulting, he'd come back to you invariably in 2 or 3 days' time and say, look, I felt I was very rude to you the other day when we were talking. I was very preoccupied. I was thinking about something else. I just phoned London and that kind of thing, you know. Mm. And even to the extent that he would sometimes make it up to you by giving you little pressies. Mm. He'd buy you a drink. And there was one time he was particularly rude to me and he gave me a rather good bottle of wine. About a week later or more, I thought I was very rude to you that day. That's a little present, sister. So he had a very sweet nature, really. Mm, mm. His outward appearance wasn't always that, but he took note of everything, you know.
And how did you find working over in London for those long stretches? I know you've already said that at times it was a bit lonely because there was an age gap between you and most of the rest of it.
Well, there was, really, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
I got along terribly well with the producer, Geoffrey Perkins.
Yeah.
But we would have been much nearer in age.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Well, I didn't find it. I wasn't alienated from anybody on the set. I wasn't sent to Coventry on the set. Mm. In fact, Paul McGlynn and I got along great.
All right, yeah.
And I describe in the book that I've just written, we were writing a rather dangerous novel. I don't know what it would have been on general sale anywhere.
Really?
It was just a joke between the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd begin a new page when we'd be off set. Start the novel and developing the plot and all that kind of thing. It's a very funny game, actually. And we were very close on the different shoots and we laughed our hearts out and she was great company.
Mm-hmm.
It was very good for my spirits. Now, when I talk about loneliness, I talk about being stuck in a room on your own in London.
Mm.
And everybody who's worked there for any length of time has experienced the same thing. You feel like a social pariah. You go out and you're looking at people fondling a lovely baby somewhere in the corner of a shop or something.
Mm.
And they look up at you fiercely and questioningly and you think, oh, my God, they think I'm some kind of a pervert. You know what I mean?
Right.
Scuttle off and then you're looking at a loving couple caressing each other in the corner of a pub and thinking how sweet it looks.
Mm.
And your man gives you a fierce stare if you fancy a bird. You don't.
You had to grow the stubble for the part as well. So you
I did. I wasn't pretty.
Yeah.
So, I was far from pretty.
Yeah.
People don't realise I can have such an appalling appearance.
Right.
I'm not pretty now. But.
Oh, you look great.
I'm all right.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks a lot, Frank. Thank you.
Great to have a listen back to that again, and interesting listening to Frank because he kind of straddled the world of comedy and serious theatre.
Let's watch the rest of the episode. Yeah, a priest's funeral was a massive thing as well because they weren't typically buried in the local graveyard. They were buried outside the chapel.
All right.
It was a big deal that you wouldn't... they weren't just buried with the rest of the plebs.
Oh,
yeah. They were right beside the church.
Straight to heaven, of course.
Straight to heaven, oh yeah, absolutely.
Mm. No delay.
Yeah. Oh, by God, a priest's funeral, you wouldn't get a seat there.
No.
No.
I've never been to a priest's funeral.
Oh, yeah.
I've never been.
Yeah, big deal.
Bishops must be unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. My God.
It's a beautiful scene, this.
It is, yeah, yeah. That's From the Dead. It's a really quality Irish film. One of the best Irish films, I would have to say.
Oh, The Dead with James, based on James Joyce.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. John Huston film.
John Huston, yeah. Mm. Nice fella. And Colin Meaney's in
his last film.
Young fella, yeah. It was his last film, I think. Yeah. And his daughter was in it, yeah. Lovely story and a great film.
The Dead. I remember reading it. It's a short story, isn't it?
It's a long short story.
Mm.
Yeah. It's like a novella.
Mm.
Yeah, but it's a beautiful story and they do it there, they parody it there.
You know, this episode is very, like a lot of episodes are very, they bring in a new character and they kind of take away from. But this episode is very much Dougal and Father Ted. And just to celebrate, very unbelievable that he died on the same date as far as Dermot Morgan. I mean, well, the chances. 365 to 1, I would say.
Oh, I'd say it's more than that.
Oh, is it?
Is it? Yeah, it probably is 365 to 1, yeah. Mm. But you know an IQ test that trick you. It's probably a million. Exactly. Yeah. So that's the end of Grant Unto Him Eternal Rest.
And it's the end of the first season.
Wow, yeah. The end of the first season. And we thought, you know, that was great.
We didn't
Might
know
never
there'd
see
be
it
another
again.
Season.
Yeah. Yeah. There was no guarantees. No. There's never a guarantee. Although I think generally, if anything's halfway decent, they'll get a second series. Mm-hmm. So probably there was a good chance if it was all right, they'd get a second series, but not like that it would become a massive hit.
True. It's probably the second series is the make or break.
Oh, it is. You've been listening to Talking Ted.
Thank you, Ardla Hanlon, for talking to us. And it was great to chat to Frank Kelly all those years ago. And what an amazing actor and a brilliant comedian and a gentleman. We are Talking Ted. Let's start talking Ted.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Head Stuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.
If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Head Stuff Plus.